No, that seemed good. Yeah, definitely. Sorry. We understand you're in an interview with media.
I wonder what about.
Sorry, if our city council
you got some duct tape up there.
Media.
Firemen are wicked.
Yes, they are.
Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Saltzman? Potter?
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the 330 time certain.
Item 760, appeal of the Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association against the hearing officer's decision to approve the application of David Douglas School District for a conditional use with an adjustment to build a new elementary school at 7010 Southeast Deardorff Road, LU07139994CUAD.
The city attorney will describe the hearing process.
Before we begin the hearing, I have several announcements to make concerning the nature of this hearing, the order of testimony, and some guidelines for presenting testimony. First, this is an evidentiary hearing. This means you may submit new evidence to the council in support of your arguments. This evidence may be in any form, such as testimony, letters, petitions, slides, photographs, maps, or drawings. Any photographs, drawings, maps, or other items you show to the council during your testimony should be given to the council clerk at the end of your testimony to make sure they become a part of the record. In terms of order of testimony, we'll begin with a staff report by Nan Stark of the Bureau of Development Services staff for approximately 10 minutes. Following the staff report, the City Council will hear from interested persons in the following order. The appellant will go first and will have 10 minutes to present the appellant's case. Following the appellant, persons who support the appeal will go next. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak to the council. The applicant will then have 15 minutes to address the city council and rebut the appellant's presentation. After the applicant, the council will hear from persons who support the applicant. Finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes to rebut the presentation of the applicant. The council may then close the hearing, deliberate, and take a vote on the appeal. If the vote is a tentative vote, the council will set a future date for the adoption of findings and a final vote on the appeal. If the council takes a final vote today, that will conclude the matter before the council. There are several guidelines for presenting testimony today. These guidelines are established by the zoning code and state law. First, testimony must be directed to the applicable approval criteria. That is, any evidence you present must be directed toward the applicable approval criteria for this land use review or other criteria in the city's comprehensive plan or zoning code that you believe apply to the decision. The BDS staff will identify the applicable approval criteria as part of the staff report to the council. If you fail to raise an issue clearly enough to give the council or the parties an opportunity to respond to the issue, you'll be precluded from appealing to the Land Use Board of Appeals based on that issue. Finally, if the applicant fails to raise constitutional or other issues relating to proposed conditions of approval with enough specificity to allow the council to respond, the applicant will be precluded from bringing an action for damages in circuit court to challenge the conditions of approval. And that concludes the opening guidelines and statements.
Thank you. Do any members of council wish to declare a conflict of interest? No council members have a conflict of interest to declare. Do any members of council have any ex parte contacts to declare or information gathered outside of the hearing to disclose? No council members have ex parte contacts to declare. Do any members of the council have questions or other preliminary matters that need to be addressed before we begin the hearing? We're going to now begin the hearing. With staff, please come forward for their presentation.
Good afternoon, Mayor Potter, Commissioner Adams, Commissioner Leonard. My name is Nan Stark. I am the staff assigned to this case, which is a new school on Deardorff Road in the David Douglas School District. It's Land Use Review 07139994CUAD. I just want to let you know that also in attendance today are staff from Bureau of Environmental Services and Portland Transportation. There are several technical issues related to the appeal, and so you may want to call upon those staff for technical issues. I'll be showing a few slides of this site and the vicinity to acquaint you with it, and then I will review the decision and describe the appeal issues. And for the sake of brevity, I'm not going to review in detail the 14 conditions of approval. They're in the decision that you have, and I've also included them in the PowerPoint if you want me to refer to those later on in your discussion. And we've also given you a copy just of the conditions of approval. So the proposal is a new elementary school for 600 students, 61 staff. It's a 16-acre site, 76,000-square-foot two-story building, 72 parking spaces, a covered play structure, no development in the environmental zones, which there are to the north and south of the site. And one adjustment was requested in the Johnson Creek Basin Plan District. There are specific regulations which limit tree removal only when trees are more than 6 inches are removed, that are more than that are requested to be removed if they're more than 10 feet from a building or 5 feet from a paved surface. Then that requires an adjustment to that standard, and in this case they requested up to 75 trees to be removed. The zoning map shows that the site is in the R10 zone, and there are C and P environmental conservation and preservation overlay zones to the north and south of the site. The primary area of development is in the middle of the site. It's totally outside of the environmental zones. And this overlay, or this aerial view, will give you a pretty good idea of what the site looks like. It's basically, it compared to the surrounding forested area, it's really quite clear. It has been residentially developed for close to 100 years, and it's kind of sitting on 16 acres with only forested area around it, separated from the nearest residential area of density by Johnson Creek to the north. And you can see there are some scattered residences along Deerdorf Road and to the south of the site, and then another concentration in a subdivision to the southeast. This is the site plan, again showing that the building footprint is towards the center of the site with access from the north and the south, the south being access directly into the parking areas and the north for school bus entry and drop-off. The adjustment regarding the trees, the concentration of trees, you can see a clump that's just to the north of the school building footprint, and there are a number of trees around that area that would be the primary target of that adjustment for the tree removal, primarily to allow site visibility and also because of some grading that's going to occur there during construction and potentially creating hazardous trees as a result. Elevation drawings. The most visible elevation will be the west along Deerdorf Road and the south coming south from Deerdorf Road. And just a few pictures of the area showing that it is quite rural in nature. Quite forested. This is one of the two houses that are still on the property. Deerdorf is a winding road. This is showing the area of the tree removal. So there's a bit of a ridge, that grade change there where the biggest concentration of trees are. that are near the footprint of the building. And this is to show you part of the wall that exists along the property, and it was built during the WPA, so it does have some historic quality, and there is a condition of approval about its preservation. This picture shows Johnson Creek, which you can see looking west from the site. And this is Cedar Crossing Bridge, which crosses Johnson Creek just to the north of the site. And this is looking south at the site from the bridge. So the approval criteria in this case are for conditional uses 33.815.105A through E, and for adjustments 33.805.040A through F. The hearings officer decision approved the conditional use for the new school with conditions that would be required prior to or during building permit review, and approval of the adjustment for removal of up to 75 trees, and conditions A through N, so 14 conditions. Three of them are transportation related. Conditions E through J are stormwater related. One is related to the neighborhood plan, and three related to the tree removal adjustment. Before I review these appeal issues, I just want to mention that during the review process and up to the publication of the staff recommendation to the hearings officer, several city staff had extensive contact with the chair of the Neighborhood Association, and the issues raised by the Neighborhood Association during the review process were primarily about the tree removal adjustment and about stormwater management and how that was going to be designed. At the hearing, those same issues were raised, and additional issues were raised about public safety and transportation related issues. And those same issues were raised in the appeal. Whoops, I didn't mean to go over that. Let me see if I can. So the transportation related issues are about site distance requirements, traffic on Deerdorf Road, the pedestrian and bike circulation, safety for all modes, and then the issue of where the sidewalk should end, potentially being hazardous. Stormwater-related issues about erosion and slope instability potential and suggested conditions of approval and the possibility for environmental review. And then additional issues raised in the appeal that policies 2 and 7 of the neighborhood plan regarding alternative modes of travel were not supported, and mitigation of 138 trees is somewhat less than a 2-to-1 ratio. And not listed in as an appeal item, but you may hear some testimony about this, is a perceived procedural error at the hearings officer level. And if you have questions following the appellant's testimony, I can address those for you. So in summary, I just want to reiterate that the hearings officer analysis shows that the proposed 600-student school can meet all of the relevant conditional use approval criteria. It's kind of a special site because of its location adjacent to Johnson Creek. It's in a heavily forested area, high in natural resources. But the site itself has been residentially developed for a long time, and most of the original forest on the site itself has likely not been there for that time. I will sum up as quickly as possible. The applicant and their representatives have worked extensively with city staff and the Neighborhood Association for the last 2 years, and the proposal has evolved over time. The critical details and concerns have really been addressed. The involvement of the neighbors and the neighborhood association during this review and at the public hearing stage has really been a key element in raising important questions about stormwater management, the tree removal, and transportation-related safety issues. And all of the conditions of approval address these concerns and are the result of input by the city's technical reviewers, the applicant's technical partners, and the neighborhood. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Can the applicant please come? The appellant please come forward.
Linda Bauer, Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association, and Dan, a citizen of the Pleasant Valley neighborhood, is here, and he's going to do our 10 minutes, and then I'll take public testimony.
Could you state your full name for the record?
My name is Dan Simmons. My address is 13153 Southeast Flavelle. First of all, I want to recognize a lot of work done by the design team and staff to get to this point. I know it's not an easy road to hoe. This site is located between where I live and where I work, so I go past this every day. About 12 trips per week for the last 15 years, roughly 9,000 trips past the site. So I've got a pretty intimate feel for what goes on here. I'm also a registered civil engineer. I do some drainage and street design in the city of Portland. So I feel sort of uniquely qualified to speak to this project. This project is special. I'm going to turn your attention to page one and the attached graphics. It's surrounded by protection zone on all four sides, and that's important because it's an island. I'm going to be addressing safety concerns regarding pedestrians, cyclists, and vehicles first, and then I'm going to be addressing environmental concerns regarding tree mitigation and drainage. There's a lot of graphics in this package. I've got another 8.5 minutes. I need to fly, so if you have any questions, feel free to stop me. The first issue has to do with the neighborhood circulation plan. I realize the city of Portland does not require that. However, I've included a sample on another project for your reference. That's page one. Page two is the more pertinent one. You can see on page two that there are some breaks in the pedestrian paths in this area. There's a pedestrian link at the covered bridge. There's going to be a proposed sidewalk in front of part of the development. There's also a public sidewalk to the south of the project on Deerdorf, and then there's the dash lines represent underdeveloped but utilized pedestrian connections in the area. Item next is on page four. This is also a sample of a site distance exhibit. I don't believe any site distance exhibits were required as part of the application process for this project either. And this relates to important information on what the site distance is for pedestrians and traffic traveling through the project. Again, I don't believe the site distance that have been accrued for this site are adequate, and traffic engineering is not my area of specialty, but I'm relying on my gut on this because I spent a lot of time on this road walking, riding my bicycle, driving car, and all kinds of weather, all times of year, just like the people that are going to be using this facility. And I've had some close calls, knock on wood, I haven't had any trouble, but I really feel that there's some evidence to prove that we need to stretch these site distances out. Page five has to do with one of the items in the appeal where a consideration of grade was not taken into account for the calculated site distance. Page six has to do with the site distance as was approved on the left-hand side, and something that I feel that would be more appropriate on the right-hand side. 170 feet site distance was approved for the project. The traffic engineer in their report recommended a 300-foot intersection site distance. The city staff had approved 170 stopping site distance. On the right-hand side, there's a graph that shows, or a table that shows stopping site distance for turning roadways of 250 feet. That could be a typo. Again, this is coming from AASHTO, and it's their document, not mine. I refer to page 7, where I've underlined on the right-hand side, the site distances are the lower limit should be available at all points along a turning roadway. Wherever feasible, longer site distances should be provided. on graphic 8. I've also found another way to determine sight distance for, and it's related to avoidance maneuvering. One of them is a stop on a rural road. It's 220 feet. I've got that circled. If you're going to move out of the way, it's 450 feet if you're going to keep going around an obstacle. If you take the 220 from this table and you add the 30 feet for the slope distance on the other table, you come up with a recommended stopping distance of 250 feet. Okay, plate 9. This is the sight distances at the south sidewalk terminus. The heavy black line is where the south sidewalk stops, and pedestrians are pretty much on their own at that point. The dashed line shows the probable path that a pedestrian is going to take. They're going to try to cross over to the bike lane, and they're going to take that bike lane up until they get to a wide spot on the outside of this curve on the southbound side of the street. I've sighted the 170-foot approved sight distance for that crosswalk, and it barely makes it. Barely. I've also plotted the 250-foot recommended sight distance that I'm proposing, and it doesn't make it at all because there's an extremely large grade obstruction on the inside of that curve. This is where the sidewalk terminates at the south end. On plate 9A, there's a picture where this proposed sidewalk is going to terminate, and I'm looking southbound. Plate 9B, I've crossed the street just like a pedestrian would to get over to the bike lane, still looking southbound. I apologize for going so quick, but I got a lot of material to cover here. 9C, same crosswalk, looking northbound. 9D, same crosswalk area, looking northbound again. I just simply crossed the street in that view. Plate 10 has to do with the north sidewalk terminus. It's designed to stop at the last driveway, the north driveway of the development. The solid line will be the public sidewalk. The dashed line is unimproved right-of-way, unimproved pedestrian way, and the solid line is actually the sidewalk on the Cedars Crossings Bridge. You can see there's a 170-foot gap between where the sidewalk ends and where pedestrians will pick up safe refuge again. In this proposal, there's no way for pedestrians, students of any kind, to use that particular stretch of road safely. In fact, the space that's available to them is right, coincidentally, at the limit of this allowed sight distance in the approval. Plate 10A, that same driveway, end of sidewalk location where people may cross or wander out into the street. Looking southbound, plate 10B, I've crossed the street, still looking southbound. 10C, same crosswalk. I'm looking northbound towards the bridge. You can see in some of these pictures, like on the next page, which is 10D, that the stripes are worn off the street. People have trouble staying between the lines. 10E is just a look at the sidewalk across the bridge. Okay. The traffic analysis report did an accident study. It was based on ODOT records, and it was basically the intersection at Flavelle and Deerdorf and at 134th and Foster. There's numerous single-car accidents that happen in this stretch of road. This is evidenced by the road flares, the broken plastic, the skid marks, lots of different things that I see on a regular basis. A lot of people crash into the bank, and they drive off. Sometimes they call the Portland police. They drive off. It's not necessarily reported to ODOT. people have trouble negotiating part of the street. They underestimate the alignment. They underestimate the grade. They underestimate the traction. They underestimate the visibility, and they get in trouble. It's a very windy road. Okay, I've got a minute and a half to talk about environmental concerns. First one is the trees. The trees have been mitigated at less than 2-to-1. If you refer to 33-430-130, E.5, when you're in an E-zone, which we are not specifically in this particular island, resource enhancement, the replacement ratio is 3-to-1. I think because this is an island in an environmental protection zone, that the resource enhancement ratio of 3-to-1 is much, much more appropriate and will restore the drainage function of the lost tree is much quicker. On plate 11, I'm showing the appropriate pre-development runoff, curve runoff for Luce and Clark days, which is a number of 70. On number 12, I'm showing the pre-development conditions as approved in the preliminary drainage calculations. What that's going to do is undercalculate the required detention. On plate 13, I believe this project is in an area where restrictive flow control is required. I've underlined the applicable section supplies to all tributaries and storm sewers that drain to tributaries in the Portland area. The post-development runoff should be, for the two-year event, should be one half of the pre-development. Currently, it's approved at two-year pre to two-year post. So in essence, for the two-year event and up to the two-year event, the water is being released twice as fast as it should be. Plate 14, we've got the pre-development existing conditions. I've shown the calculated in the square dot. I've shown the assumed point of pre-development discharge. For the green highlighted area, I'm showing the with a triangle the actual point of pre-development discharge for that particular point. If you go to the very last page in the book, plate 15, we have a much larger basin 3. It's all going to discharge above the E zone. Now, I don't know how much of the background information you got on the appeal, but the 33815105E has limits on what can be discharged into the 33815105D.3 has limits on what can be discharged into an environmental zone. Maximum discharge slope below a discharge is 15%, but you can see on this graphic it approaches 28%. I believe that's going to cause some erosion problems, even with the flow splitter. On the other problem I have with this particular detention calculation is that even though the calculated release is at the top of the page on plate 14, in reality, it's going to be a much larger area by one acre, and it's going to be discharged higher. Basically, the proposed design shows it being discharged on a fill slope that is above the environmental zone. Now, true, they are not discharging directly in the environmental zone, but water just behaves according to the laws of physics. It's going to roll downhill, and it's going to be in that E zone within 30 or 40 feet. And I think the intent of that particular section of the code needs to be respected with this particular design.
You're going to have to wrap it up, sir.
Okay. The last item is the blue highlights on page 15. The south driveway has about 2,300 square feet of a private runoff that we treated in the public right-of-way. The north driveway has about 2,900 square feet of private runoff that it goes untreated completely. In conclusion, we support this project. We don't support the actual conditions of approval that are associated with this project. I believe that the conditions must adequately address the safety and environmental concerns. In my opinion, they don't. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. You can go back and sit down. It's okay. I'd like to bring the staff back up so they could respond to these issues. Staff, could you come forward and respond to the issues that were raised by the appellant?
Doesn't David Douglas testify?
Yes. Well, I wanted to hear from staff specific to that. Yes.
So most of those issues raised were pretty technical. So I am asking the staff from Environmental Services and PDOT to respond to those.
Please state your name when you speak and try to be very brief.
Okay. Eric Brennecke with BES, Portland Building.
Bob Haley, Office of Transportation.
I think, one of the questions that came up was discharging into the E zone. The April 2nd drainage report does indicate that the drainage does not affect the E-zone. It is utilizing an existing ditch along the basalt wall on Deerdorf Road. So it's we designed it that way so we don't have to affect the E-zone area. We're utilizing existing conditions, existing ditch conditions out there in the field. Secondly, the curve number was indicated to be 70. 74 was used. It's to mimic the Lewis and Clark days. It's hard to pinpoint what that is, but the conditions, the engineer that did the site visit to indicate what that curve number should be was 74. That's a fair assumption at this point for this to assume what it is for the existing conditions, and that it was used in the analysis.
So I'm sorry, I've never heard the term Lewis and Clark days.
Right, it's in the stormwater management manual. It's to...
You know, I just haven't gotten to that. So.
Right. And, you know, people talk about it, but it's always a...
Sam's reading it right now as we speak. It's very
interesting. So it's always a debatable discussion, but...
literally mean from the era of Lewis and Clark? Yes,
correct.
Like 1805?
And it's, you know, we're trying to figure out what those conditions are, but that's what it states in the manual. So, you know, 70 to 74 for the curve number, the engineer made the assumption, the fair assumption of 74 in this case.
74 represents what?
Basically the impervious area of the site.
It's a way to measure drainage?
Yes, it's kind of a... It takes into account moisture content of the soil when you compose your runoff calculations. So, also for sediment control, the within our stormwater manual indicates that the post half, the post 2 years should match the half of the existing 2 year.
Is there a way you could put that into everyday language?
No, <try. laughs> it's to really control our sediment control, and those are the standards set that the 2 year storm event should match the half of the 2 year existing conditions, and it's just really to control a certain volume of water, and that's what the engineer has indicated in his stormwater report.
If I could just, you have, you know, you're trained in analyzing these technical issues. Is that accurate to say?
Correct.
And you've looked at the outside engineer's assumptions and work, correct?
Correct.
And you have compared that against the analysis provided by Mr. Simons. The concerns that he's provided, correct?
Correct. The issues that he raised today.
And do you find merit with any of the concerns that he has provided?
I do respect his concerns that he raised. This is water resources. It's not an exact science. So there's a lot of assumptions that are made. And we only can make the best assumptions with the curve number based on the land use proposal in front of us. It's a very conceptual project right now, so we're not dealing with final engineering drawings at this point, so a lot of it is assumption based.
So for those of us, though, that are not versed in the technical sort of, we're not, we just don't know that some of this technical issues that you're raising help us judge whether or not Mr. Simon's concerns are valid. I don't know who else to turn to.
Sure. I think his assumptions or what the points that he raised are valid. I do believe that the report that we do have for this project stands alone to be on its own merits substantial. I think it's fair, and I think it does reflect what we have outlined in our stormwater management manual.
Does that sound like both sides are right?
Sorry?
Are you saying both sides are right?
No,
I think you have to be a little more definitive. Sorry.
Okay. I believe the report that we have for this project do meet the guidelines of the stormwater management manual.
And the report, when you say the report, you're referring to
the
what?
The drainage, the stormwater.
Authored by who? The applicant's consultant?
Correct.
So you think that it does meet the requirements of the code?
Correct.
Okay. Although you've also said there's a certain amount of judgment involved and that Mr. Simons does raise some good concerns, but you still think after hearing those concerns that the report does meet the requirements of the code?
Correct.
Thank you.
If I could just interject.
We're doing good right now.
Briefly.
Yeah. don't muddy the water, as it were.
Would you like to clarify something?
No, just from a non-technical standpoint of the person who is facilitating the process, the original submittal was deemed inadequate to the Bureau of Environmental Services, and there were actually 6 months of the application being incomplete between July and December last year. During that time, we got additional information that BES reviewed, responded to. So there were actually several iterations of the stormwater management plan that was submitted up to the day before the public hearing, which is when we received the final document. And so BES was able to come to the hearing having reviewed it the night before and put together a response supporting it. So it's not... It was a pretty evolutionary process.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, folks.
Comments on the concerns about transportation issues?
I just wanted to kind of emphasize again that I think PDOT and the school district are extremely committed to making sure that whatever facilities we construct out here are essentially for the safety of the users and the neighborhood itself. The idea that it's an isolated section of sidewalk is something that you're all very familiar with, is the way we get improvements in Portland. So I won't go over that one too much. The site distance, I'm not a traffic engineer. We do have our traffic engineer if you want to talk about the AASHTO standards and which version and which method was used. My basic understanding is the ones that Mr. Simmons was calling out were for the used in the design of roadways, where there's another AASHTO standards for stopping distance and site distance that we use for intersections, and that's what the city relied on in setting the analyzing the site distance for the driveways. The driveways do meet it. It's not ideal. As you saw, it was a curvy road with about a 7% slope, but we do, with some grading and some tree removal, we'll meet it, the minimums. The other thing that'll be a slight mitigating factor, we hope, is it'll be signed as a school zone with 20-mile-an-hour speed zones during school. So the site distances that we're even achieving now at the 85th percentile of 27 miles an hour should get even a little bit better. The exact location of where these sidewalks will terminate on both the north and the south is really difficult, because where it's good on for a pedestrian to cross one side, it's not so great because you're on the opposite side of a curb coming back. We have been, even in recent discussions with the school district or with their representatives, of trying to see if we can end the standard curb, swale, 6-foot sidewalk, street trees, street lights on the south end, and see if we can then switch as we go through the environmental zone section to that hairpin turn. We might be able to cut the bank back a little bit and just put in a hard surface path that's separated from the road by its natural ditch, and try and get that all the way either to the very southern end of the property or just a little bit further to Flavelle. And I think we can accomplish that.
That's going north from the site, basically. South from the site.
South from the site to down to Lavelle, which would be a really good increase. The northern end you saw is difficult because we've got that retaining wall that has some historic quality that starts off about 5 feet high but gets about 15 foot high, and that's P-zoned. And if you look on top of that, there's a lot of trees up there. So if we start cutting into that retaining wall to get a sidewalk there, it gets a little more tricky and much more expensive as well. The school has acknowledged that they are willing to do it if that's what we have to do. But what I'd like to do is just, we want to defer the exact location of where these sidewalks end until we get into the actual civil final engineered drawings of it, so we can get details of what these slopes are like and see if we can get some facility, even if it's just a 4-foot concrete path that doesn't have curbs or anything else, but gives a little bit of refuge, or find a better place to cross. But there will be signing. There will be lights. We have other options of different types of signing and different times. I know it doesn't address what will happen on weekend use or evening use if people decide to want to use the playfield or if the school is open for it, but I think that's something the school district can represent. They are not anticipating people walking. I know that was an assumption that the neighborhood had difficulty with students getting there. The David Douglas School has lowered their 1-mile limitation on bus service, and they have committed to giving every single student, providing bus service to every single student at that school. So there shouldn't be a reason for a child to walk.
Wait a minute. But we want to facilitate children safely walking to and from school.
Well, at this point, until there is a connection, it really isn't a place. I've been up on this site a number of times and walking it, and I don't even like walking it myself. But we are building the facilities that someday will connect to something that does meet the goal of providing for other modes. We are widening the road 6 feet on the school side. The school district and the street job will grind that yellow line stripe out and move it 6 feet closer to the school to provide for a bike lane uphill, which is where, because a cyclist coming down that hill shouldn't have any problem keeping up with cars, but we will get a bike lane out of it. We'll have a nice sidewalk. This is a little over, as shown on the site plan, about 1,200 feet of frontage improvements. If we can get a path connection to Flavelle, that will add another probably 200 or 300 feet to that.
So I am familiar with the site. I drive by it at least twice a day. It is, as it was represented, a very dangerous site for pedestrians and bicyclists. So I was interested in your comments going up to Lavelle, hopefully having some at least pathway that's mm-hmm. better than what's there now, which is nothing. But then how about going back to the bridge north? What is contemplated there?
I think we want to take a real close look at where the bottom of that kind of historic retaining wall is and the edge of the pavement. Right now that is, they've done a lot of their stormwater work to try and avoid having to do any improvements in that section that would require the removal of the wall.
But the wall is on the opposite side of the walkway that's on the bridge.
Right.
So people will have to cross to get there. So why... I guess I'm wondering, why wouldn't we have the flow of the pedestrian traffic stay on the same side of the walkway as the bridges? Because obviously people will use that, and there's more space.
If you're familiar with the road and you've gotten out and stood and looked down in the west side of it.
Well, I have. Yeah.
I mean, constructing a sidewalk over there would be completely engineered, cantilevered out, and roadway. Plus, that's all environmental P-zone with Johnson Creek. So. While there is, yes, you're right, the only sidewalk on that bridge is a small one, as you know, on the left side with a handrail. What we want to do is just, we know it's not ideal, but at least get a crossing that is as safe as possible over to the other side so they can walk across the bridge.
So I want to focus on this wall a bit. Am I understanding that implicit in the concern is to try to preserve the wall? Is that
I think there is a desire to preserve the wall partly on the grounds, I think the school would like it. They think it would have impacts on sort of the neighborhood character. I mean, that wall is part of it.
So are there any legal requirements to preserve the wall, or is it just
no legal it has no legal historic status, as I now understand.
Because just from my perspective, and I may get scowls for this, I think the wall is secondary to the safety. Mm-hmm. So to me, if it's an issue of whether or not to have a sidewalk that's safe and preserving the wall, I would choose the sidewalk because it is a very dangerous. People do come flying through there. So I think my interest would be in knowing the folks that I serve mm-hmm. with here and their focus on safe routes to schools and whatnot. I am pretty confident most of us would decide on safety mm-hmm. over the whatever historical preservation attempt.
And it may be that if it's needed to take the sidewalk all the way to the bridge, where then you just cross at the bridge, or is it better 50 feet before the bridge? I mean, where is the best place for sight lines and people to get
That's what I was going to get to. I was going to get, because I was actually reassured when I heard you say basically that you wanted some time after this process to determine what the safest placement mm-hmm. would be.
Yeah.
So is it safe for me to conclude, if I support this as is, that you guys will take all of these factors into consideration, but in any event, you intend to have a sidewalk to the bridge? You intend to have some pathway of some kind to Flavelle.
I think we can commit to trying to get as close to those as we can if it's feasible and constructible to do.
And is the reservation preserving the wall?
Preserving the wall is one. Terminating the sidewalk where it's safest for pedestrians to eventually cross over to the other side of the bridge is probably the first.
I appreciate David Douglas's aspirational goal to not have students walk. As a practical matter, I don't believe that will happen. And I also don't believe we'll make it safe by just having the sidewalk on the south side of the bridge. I think we need to talk a little bit about when we get across Johnson Creek to the north side of the bridge, and there's a hairpin turn that heads west, and then there's another hairpin turn that turns north. If we could somehow figure out how to get a route up to 134th where it's heading north, mm-hmm.
I think we look at that. I mean, the closest sidewalk to the south is approximately 2,000 feet.
I'm not so concerned about sidewalks as I am safe refuge
just
spaces.
Okay.
And so I think if we can somehow figure out how to navigate around those two hairpin turns so we're at mm-hmm. that straight 134th portion that goes to Foster, I realize they're not sidewalks, and I'm not as concerned about that because I think once people navigate the hairpin turns, there's ways to be away
from them. So are you suggesting that we consider off-site improvements that the school district will be required to construct?
I'm throwing that out there as a practical matter. I mean, I know I know the school district doesn't want kids to be in harm's way. I'm mm-hmm. knowing kids, I think they will be riding bikes and they will be walking. You know, not everybody will take the bus for whatever reason, so I just know that there will be pedestrian and bicycle traffic. I don't want to hold the project up on the other. I think as a practical matter, we need to understand that it's dangerous beginning at where that hairpin turn curves begins. If you can imagine being on 134th heading south, the first hairpin
right at the top of the hill.
Right at the top, from there to the school, I think we need to have a safe route. Whatever that means. It doesn't mean sidewalks to me, but it means safe space.
Hmm. I think we can take a look. I don't know. The school may. I'd like for you to hear about them. But
there's cars that park there now, for an example. We could do something like this. I'm just throwing this out off the top of my head. No parking.
Remove parking.
No parking. So if you had no parking there, then it opens up that space hmm. there for pedestrians.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm
saying. So if there's a shoulder and it's used for parking and we can make it
yes.
safer for pedestrians, I think you could find a lot of support for
and
that.
The answers to those two things are yes, by the way. There is a shoulder
okay.
and there is parking there.
I was just more concerned about committing us to taking out trees in the right of way that are right now in people's front yards and they think
you might have to do a little. I'm not sure that you okay. don't at some point there have to do a little bit of that right at the bridge, but again, to me, the safety of the kids is paramount. I don't think as a practical matter we can say nobody's going to walk there.
Okay.
Nobody's going to ride a bike there.
I think we could commit to doing whatever is practical and reasonable.
Okay.
And with the support of the school, obviously. Yeah.
And we would help, too. I mean, if we needed to do something to help, obviously we'd find ways to help.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I think, I defer defer to my colleague because he knows the terrain, but I share his aspirations for safe and as practical.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Are there persons who support the appeal who wish to speak? Is there a sign-up sheet?
No one signed up.
I think Linda wants to. Linda.
Yeah, I'm coming. Right. There were a couple here. Can you look at this out in the hallway? Dan, can sure.
You? You have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. It says two. Oh, sorry.
Trying to cheat Linda
he
out of
was.
1 minute.
She wouldn't do that.
Thank you, Linda.
Linda Bauer, Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association. At the hearing, David Douglas School District changed their request for an adjustment for 75 trees to an adjustment for 65 trees. But the hearings officer forgot to change the decision. So I would like to see the city council change the decision. I mean, the school district requested 65 instead of 75. So now would be the time to make that change because the hearings officer forgot. And the thing on the half of the 2-year 24-hour event, when an applicant is required to do half of the 2-year 24-hour event, it means he can only release half of the regular required amount of water. In order to do that, he has to store the other half of the water on the site. So he has to do the calculation so he'll know, hey, he has enough room on his site to store all the water that he can't release right away. He has to release it at half of the 2-year event. Everybody else releases their water at a 2-year event. People who are releasing their water directly to a ditch or to a stream can only release half of the 2-year event, which means then they have to have a storage facility to take care of the water that they're not allowed to release at a faster rate. So that's why doing the half of the 2-year storm event calculation is important. This site, as you could tell from the maps, is very tight, and so they could have some troubles down the road once they do the actual calculation and then don't have room to do the storage. So, questions? Thank you.
People going?
Is there somebody else? We'll now hear from the applicant or the principal opponent. Please come forward.
Mayor, councilmen, my name is Terry Rommel. I'm the architect for the David Douglas School District. And with me are members of our design team in case you have any questions about how we came to our conclusions in our design technically. I would like to show you 7 slides of the WPA project with the retaining wall, the bridge, and other elements. So you can get an understanding of what we're talking about a little more thoroughly than the previous presentation by Nan. So this is the Cedar Crossing Bridge. As you can see on the left, there's a stone retaining wall that goes under the bridge as a support for the bridge system. The next slide is the west side of that wall that you saw. It's a retaining wall. There's a pull-out area for the for traffic at that area. If we wind up crossing, putting in the extension of the sidewalk, that perhaps would be a good place for the crossing to occur. This is the low end of the retaining wall. As you can see, there's a lot of growth on it, and it actually returns and heads east along the bank for about 200 or 300 feet. This is looking to the west at that turnout area, plus you can see there's a gate post where there used to be a gate on the, there's a road that's cut in there below the bank that's not used anymore. And this is the entire basalt wall that we're talking about. And as you can see, there are quite a number of trees that exist along the top side of the bank or in the bank. This is the end of the ditch. The bank is on the left, or excuse me, the right. And that opening at the end is where the water goes into a pipe and exits into Johnson Creek. This is the wall as it extended around to the east into the E zone. It is completely covered with ferns and other plant materials. And that's, I just wanted you to show you these slides to give you an idea of what exists in this space.
Thank you.
As you're aware, the David Douglas School District is a fast-growing district. Is it overcrowded? The school board took over 2 years to find a site to build a new elementary school. They were able to find this one. It contained 16-plus acres, but it has about eight acres of usable land. It's not perfect by any means, but it was what was available without condemning private residences. We started in the spring of 2006 with the intention of starting construction after a bond in 2006, but it failed. But we're so long in this conditional use process that the school district decided to complete that so that when funding did become available, we'd have this process out of the way. Our approach was to respect the special amenities, history, and culture of the site and the neighborhood. It is within the city limits, but it has a very rural feeling, as shown by the slides that Nan presented. There is minimal infrastructure in the area. There are no sidewalks, no curbs, minimal street lighting, and no water service in front of our site. And Johnson Creek is the focal point of the neighborhood. The structures supporting and around the Cedar Crossing Bridge were built by the WPA with Columbia basalt rock for the retaining walls, railings, gate posts, and bridge supports. It is our opinion there exists a great deal of heritage in all these elements that should be maintained. We have two actual lots that compose our site, 7010 and 7144 Deerdorf Road. The site at 7144, the south site, has been occupied or owned by one family since 1923 and used as farming. I'm not quite sure on the north site, but the whole area has been farmland for quite some time. Our intent is to work with the city and the neighborhood to make sure that the city design criteria is met and we become a good member of the neighborhood. Most of the issues that are listed in the appeal were brought up at the public hearing and not addressed. We did not know about them prior to the public hearing. Our process has lasted over a year and a half, and we've had many meetings with BES, PDOT, and the Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association Board. We made every effort to work with the city staff to meet the design criteria. Plus, we reached out to the Neighborhood Association by providing them their own documents when requested. For the neighborhood, we provided an extra conditional use permit document so they did not have to get them from BDS. Linda Bauer submitted numerous emails entitled For the Record, asking how special issues in our proposal were being addressed. Each time, we responded in a timely manner to answer the questions the best we could. After the hearings officer issued his report, she called me, asked we request the hearing be reopened so that one or two community members could submit additional written information. These people did not understand they needed to request the record be held open and able to do this. To show our willingness to cooperate, I delivered a written request to the hearings officer's clerk on May 6th and received a written denial in the mail on May 7th. On May 7th, I met with the PNVA board to discuss their concerns. At that meeting, the conclusion, the board voted for an appeal. At that meeting, Dan Simons was reporting his concerns. He had many concerns regarding stormwater management, and he kept saying he didn't have a complete report, and I don't know if he has a complete report yet. When Linda filed for the appeal, she called me and asked if she could get a a copy of the final stormwater report to the city, and I said, yes, I'll get it for you. On May 14th, I called her, told her it was available. She said she would pick it up in my office, and it's still there. So I don't know if they have current information or not, but the final report.